Welcome to The Bookshelf. I'm Chris Massini. Tonight, we continue Kim Barnes' novel, A Country Called Home. Chapter 16. It was Elise's voice that brought Manny running from his pickup. Not a call for help, but a near scream. Daddy! Three times she cried it, as though she were calling him back from the dead. But Jesus God, he had not expected to see Derricott dragging the girl across the yard as she twisted to get away, her skirt muddied and torn. Manny didn't know that the words had left his mouth until Derricott stopped and turned his way, and so he said it again. Let her go, Thomas. And Derricott did. He let the girl go. Manny relaxed the clench of his fists. He hadn't thought beyond the words, but he knew now that he'd been ready to strike, to take Derricott to the ground. Elise ran, weeping, toward the barn, and he wanted to follow her to make sure she was all right. But Derricott had turned his face to him, his eyes a jolt of gray-white, and Manny knew that this must be settled somehow between them. The dog stayed at his heel, tense, ready. Manny feared that, even wrecked with age, she would attack Derricott, close the distance between them before he could stop her. Derricott held up both clenched hands, pounded them once against his thighs, and then opened his fingers across his knees and began sinking as though his shoulders were a yoke cast in iron, his spine soft lead. Manny lunged to catch him, and both of them went down, Derricott making little sounds like an animal dying or in the throes of birth. Dog, sensing mercy, licked their hands. Derricott was crying, though it sounded more like a series of coughs, each sob like a jab to the breastbone, expelling puffs of air. Manny smelled the sourness of Derricott's clothes, the clabbered breath, the hair grown long at the collar. But what could he say? Such observation might shame them both, drive them more firmly into the silence that had settled between them. Here, he nudged Derricott upright, let's get in the house, get warm. He stood and pulled Derricott up after him. He tried not to be too tender, though Derricott was rain wet and trembling. They trundled across the yard and through the door. Manny led Derricott to a kitchen chair, took his jacket, and hung it along with his own on pegs behind the stove. He filled the coffee pot and put out a plate of fig bars. He was sure Elise had gone to his apartment. He would let things settle, give her some time. He brought the coffee and whiskey and sat at the table with Derricott. They'd made a mess of the floor, weeks since the flood, and he was still dozing the mud, moving it from one ditch to another, from mound to mound, like shoveling sand. He pushed the cookies closer to Derricott before taking one for himself. He wondered if Derricott was clear-headed enough for the whiskey to help. Derricott wiped back several thin strands of hair, his hand shaking. "I'm not fit for this," he said. "Not any of it." Manny took his time chewing, poured a little whiskey to cool his coffee, which he needed sooner rather than later. Derricott pulled a cigarette from his pack and rested both arms on the table. "I came in, and she was lying face down on the floor, arms out like she was dead." He drank his coffee in a single draw and poured straight whiskey. "They told her that the devil is in her eyes." Derricott leaned back in his chair. "And she believes it."
"There's been a lot of stuff she's believed," Manny said. "She'll get over it."
Another pour of whiskey. Derricott's mouth worked around the liquid as though he were eating glass. Manny would talk to Elise, convince her of the lies that they were telling her, make her laugh, just as he had when she was little, shooing the monsters from beneath her bed, the ghosts from her closet, bringing another nightlight, convincing her that she was safe. "Maybe the best thing is to let it ride for a while. Wait and see how things go." Manny picked up the mugs and moved to the sink. The scant shot would make him more sleepy than relaxed, and he wished he hadn't drunk it. He needed to get through the day's work. He hoped his boots had dried some. "I've already told her," Derricott said. "She's not to leave the house." He rose, reached for his jacket, and slammed out the door. Manny wasn't sure where Derricott was headed. Maybe to the river. Right now, he didn't care. He rinsed the mugs and placed them in the drainer, then pulled on his boots and coat and stepped outside, dog limping beside him. The Volkswagen was gone. He He noted the slew of mud, rock, and debris that still burned the barn's north side. The rush of rain and snowmelt down the draw had nearly wiped the barn off its piers. If Dewey and Stubb hadn't done such a good job of anchoring it, it would all be gone, and he realized how much he missed their sturdy presence. He climbed the narrow stairs and knocked lightly before opening his own door. Elise was lying on the couch, covered with what had once been Allegro's saddle blanket. He had washed it, offered it to her as a remembrance, but she had shaken her head. Since that time, it had draped the back of his worn sofa, gone from utility to decor. Dog wanted to nuzzle and lick Elise, but Manny pointed to the floor and she sat, the stub of her tail beating a phantom rhythm. Manny thought that the dog loved Elise almost as much as him, and he was glad. The girl was something of an orphan, and he understood how the church might fill that need for family, all those brothers and sisters caring so dearly for your soul. Manny folded a piece of bread around a swath of peanut butter and heated milk for hot chocolate, fixing it the way she liked, a dash of cinnamon on top, and then sat down across from her, noting the quick rise and fall of her breathing. "Here's some cocoa and a sandwich. Get you through dinner." "I'm not hungry," she said, her voice muffled, childlike. Manny set the plate and mug on the old bench that served as a resting place for his books and for his heels when he was reading. "Well, here it is anyway. Eat what you want." He waited. He needed to get the tractor unrigged and put away, animals fed. But he couldn't imagine leaving her, sad and alone, beneath the old wool blanket, its stripes shrunken and bleeding into one another because he had failed to remember what some mother most surely had taught him: never wash wool in hot water. He thought of the scratchy remnant of his father's horse blanket that he had carried from house to house, how each good woman in succession had attempted to wrest it from his hands, sure it harbored fleas, how he'd bawled and fought until they'd given up, but kept their eye on it as though it were a sappish cur. He couldn't recall when he last had it in his possession. How could he have held on to something so fiercely and not remember letting it go? The dog lay down, drowsy with warmth. Maybe he'd let his boots dry for a few minutes, then get to it. He sat in the chair closest to the window and dozed. When he heard Elise stir, he watched through half-closed eyes as she fed Dog the sandwich, then set the mug on the floor to be lapped clean. He could have questioned her actions, but didn't, because he was seeing something he hadn't noted before: the pallor of her skin, the joints of her elbows swollen against the thinness of her arms, the sunken hollow at her neck. Beneath the sweaters, the tangled skirt, she was nothing but a clutter of bones. It had happened so fast. How could he have missed such a dwindling? When she rose and took the empty plate and cup to the sink, Manny pretended a yawn. "That tasted good," Elise said. "Thanks." Manny smiled because he didn't know what else to do. "I guess I'll go home now." "Okay. I don't think I'll be hungry for dinner. Maybe I'll just go to bed." "Okay." She looked out the window, the moon rising over Angel Ridge. "Do you think we'll ever find her?" Manny wondered what answer he should give other than the one that was true. "No," he said. "We'll never find her." He waited until her steps had left the stairway, then watched from the window as she walked to the house, her skirts catching the wind coming up off the river. He pulled the blanket to his lap and wondered at the disappearance of that girl he'd taken to the fair only months before, sassy in her showy clothes, smoking with the bravado of a barmaid. He felt a sudden and knowing sadness that somehow he had failed. Like Derricott, he wasn't fit for any of it. He would put the tractor away, feed the animals. He'd clean the mud from the kitchen, and while he was doing these things, he would plan dinner. Something Elise would smell and be unable to resist: fried chicken, mashed potatoes and gravy, carrots cooked in butter and brown sugar. He wished Allegro were still with them. He wished for his father's giant horses that had carried him so carefully across the land. He wished for Helen, for things to be like they were before. "Come," he said to Dog, "we got work to do." They went out into the almost dark, stopping long enough to note the car lights following the river's curve. In a few more hours, the temperature would drop and the roads become sheer with ice. He wished he could warn those distant travelers, tell them of the dangers ahead. He fired up the tractor and steered toward the barn. Already he could hear the old crow mawing for feed. The hens were down to four, the rest gone to raccoons and an overly lustful rooster who killed with his splendid ardor, then was himself carried off in the soft muzzle of a fox. The goat pens were empty, the horse stall given over to spiders and pack rats. It was a diminishment he believed he could live with, a reduction that intensified the care of what was left, although there were times when, lying in bed, he felt the immense emptiness of the barn below him. By the time Thomas returned home, Manny would have the food on the table, maybe a pecan pie, maybe a shot of whiskey after dinner when it was right. He would put on some quiet music that would have pleased Helen and would prove to Elise that the devil was not in her. Maybe he'd go to the church with her. Maybe they would shift their gaze toward him, divine all the demons that he harbored. The cow grunted as he pitched the hay and threw the chickens their scratch. "Come, dog," he said, and headed toward the house, where light illuminated the kitchen. Through the window, he could see Elise at the table, her head bowed. He saw her stand, raise her arms, and begin to sway. He thought he could hear the sing-song repetition of her praise. She looked like a crazy woman, her hair matted, her skirt torn. She brought the tips of her fingers to her eyes and then raised her hands. Two times she did this, as though her eyes were twin mouths, her fingers ferrying kisses to heaven. And as she brought her fingers down for the third time, he saw the look on her face change. No longer peaceful in prayer, but angry, like the face of an enraged child. She shook her head, cupped her ears as though trying to keep the sound of the world at bay. And then she brought her fingers to her face and began clawing as though she meant to blind herself. Manny ran to the door and reached the table as the chair skittered from beneath her. He grabbed her wrist, pulled her hands away, dog barking wildly beside him. Elise was screaming, thrashing. Manny straddled her thin body and pinned her to the floor. She was wrenching her head back and forth, and all he could see were the scratches along her cheeks, the dark spatter of her lashes. He held her there until she had exhausted herself. She was crying, and the thought of the salt and the wounds made him groan. He rolled her into his lap, felt how small she'd become, and clasped her wet face to his chest. He heard the car turning in and saw the headlights cut across the window. "Hurry," he whispered, swaddling the girl in her rags, rocking, rocking, humming a lullaby that came from some heart once held close to his own. Chapter 17. The lawn stretched down the hill to the road, and the road circled the complex of low-roofed buildings before leading back to Fife. Beneath each oak, maple and elm was a bench, and on each bench was a brass plate etched with the names of people who had donated to the Clearwater Hospital Foundation. Green knuckles of daffodils punched up through the thawing earth. Morning and evening, deer browsed the budding leaves of mulberry and laurel. Elise watched them from the meal room, where she would stay until she had eaten some part of what they placed in front of her. After breakfast, lunch, and dinner, the aides ran gloved fingers along her gums, under her tongue. They weighed her clothes, weighed her food, weighed her again, and then her clothes again, whose seams were inspected for pennies she might have sewn into the hem. They watched her urinate, defecate. They charted the length of time it took her to brush her teeth and cautioned her to spit only once. Even her saliva was enough to tip the scales. The psychiatrist who came from Folgate on Wednesdays said it was temporary dementia brought on by anorexia that had caused her to hurt herself. Pastor Maggie came as her spiritual advisor and insisted it was Satan. She didn't know what to believe, which way was right, and so she prayed and took her medicine. She read the Bible, she wrote in the journal the counselor said she could keep. She didn't tell the counselor about the night of the rain, the music she had played with Todd beside her, the water flooding the floor. She'd run upstairs to warn Todd and his parents, but they were already bunched together, whispering. It was she who had brought the sin into God's house, Mrs. Maggie told her, and now they would all be punished. Her memories came to her like a dream, their injunction that she purge herself with fasting and prayer. Finally, when starving herself had not erased the color of music, she took the Bible they had given her and let it fall open, just as the preacher had done, to the book of Mark. And if thine eye offend thee, pluck it out. Starving yourself will not cure you, the psychiatrist said. Seeing colors when you hear music is a condition known as synesthesia. It's not uncommon. Why then, she wondered, had fasting brought such peace? The first few days she'd craved everything, oatmeal, hamburger buns, black plums. But then the congregation had prayed over her and the hunger had gone away. She felt she could live forever without food. Was it a sin that she had lied to Manny, telling him she'd eaten when she hadn't, flushing soup down the toilet, the empty bowl evidence of her appetite? She gave her sandwiches to Dog, left the crust. The more complex her deception, the more satisfied she felt. An omelet might take an hour of preparation, chopping the ham, grating the cheese, keeping the heat low enough not to scorch. And then the whole of it thrown to the chickens, who fell upon the eggs with carnivorous delight. She wanted to get better, to go back home to Dog and Manny, to see Todd again. When called to the meal room, she marched forward, reciting from the Song of Solomon. He brought me to the banqueting house, and his banner over me was love. A chant that did not vary in tone as she slid into her chair. Honey and milk are under thy tongue. A kiss of sweet tea. Apples, pomegranates, cinnamon, spiced wine. A slice, a seed, dark juice. Let my beloved come into his garden and eat his pleasant fruits. Still, no matter how hard she tried, she couldn't swallow more than a few bites without her stomach knotting. She did what the counselor suggested to keep her mind off the food and engaged the other patients in dinner conversation. What is the name of your horse? She asked Belinda, a blonde-haired rodeo queen who was relieved of her duties when the toilet backed up in the royalty RV, bags of corn chips and packages of Oreos, the Hershey bars she'd secreted in her boot duffel, everything she ingested and regurgitated while standing in the closet-like bathroom with her hand ready to flush. Even with the few pounds she'd gained, Belinda looked hollow, her skin nearly translucent over the shell of her forehead, the scallops of her cheeks. After each bite, she lowered her fork, pressed her lips together, and breathed through her nose for a count of 10. Elise counted with her, exhaled in unison. Elise asked Rodney, round-bellied and balding, "Which stone was your favorite?" He had collected them, first as a hobby, then an obsession, the garnets and tourmaline giving way to chunks of dull granite, buckets of pebbles hauled off in the river that filled his bedroom and spilled into his kitchen. And then came the grass and ferns potted in loose soil, an introduction of butterflies, night crawlers lifted from the dewy lawn, two rubber boas and a clutch of spider eggs that erupted and spread to the corners of every room. A dozen starlings trapped and released, ladybugs and bats, squirrels, and a small maple dug from the neighbor's lot. An electronic sprinkler system. Finally, the floor had collapsed, producing a pleasing landscape of arroyos in the basement. A biosphere, Rodney insisted. A perfect creation, don't you see? But a favorite stone? He had none. All rocks were equal in his eyes. Each evening after dinner, Elise read a chapter of Pilgrim's Progress to Sarah, a plump 35-year-old given to filling her orifice with spoons, candles, candy canes, anything she might pilfer and privy away. Sarah thought that Pilgrim wore a buckled hat and shoes, that he was questing not for salvation but for turkeys. Elise had tried at first to dissuade such interpretation, but had finally given up, allowing Sarah to weave the story of Faithful and Hopeful and the Celestial City into a tale filled with Indians and muskets and maize. In the last hour before bed, Elise would pull on her coat and walk Mr. Lambert out to the patio for his nightly look at the stars. Moderately tall and handsome, he appeared sane in every way, clean, courteous, and intelligent. Only his stance seemed a bit off. He tilted to the left, chin tucked, as though he were being reined into a tight circle. He needed a steadying hand at his elbow, which Elise offered, and as they pointed and named the constellations, he would smoke a single pipe of tobacco. White mustache and neatly combed hair, Elise thought he looked like a British gentleman. But when he had asked where his family was from, if perhaps he'd been raised in England, the corners of his mouth had drooped, and he'd begun rolling his lower lip. No, he said, not England. Surely she could see he was from Nazareth. His shoulders slumped forward, the pipe fell from his hand, and he began braying like a donkey. Ah, Christ, Sarah said. He's Mary's ass again. And they hurried to tell the attendant. The preacher had told Elise that it would help if she were baptized, that it would wash away her sins. The staff couldn't argue against such religious expression, and so the preacher and his wife had come, and, along with the aide, convened in the tub room, once used for hydrotherapy, now vacant except for the porcelain tub itself, long and solid as a crypt, surrounded by nothing but gray tile. Elise, dressed in a white hospital gown, stepped over the high rim and sat with her legs extended, cold water to her waist. Why, Pastor Maggie had asked, are we gathered here today? So that I might be washed in the blood of the Lamb, Elise answered. Then I baptize you in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost. And he had covered her head in his hands and tipped her back until the water covered her face. Sister Maggie shouted and danced a tight step between the tub and the wall. The minister beamed and was proud in a way her father had never been. Since then, it had become part of her free time ritual to bring the water to the edge overflowing, ease herself into the tub, and slide beneath the surface. At first, the aide had bellowed her name, jerked her up by her hair. I won't let myself drown, Elise had promised. Watch and see. So they'd watched her, and each time she resurfaced, she smiled and told them how peaceful it felt, how therapeutic, until they'd left off their vigil. Sometimes she wished that the preacher had held her down a while longer, long enough for her to listen more carefully to the rattle of pipes, the spark of electricity in the walls, drowning out the languid music piped into every room that made her woozy with ennui. Such truer sound the water carried, and she'd felt like a tuning fork tapped against the porcelain rim, set humming. Elise was in the bath, water filling her ears, when they brought the new patient into the hospital, the heaviest doors unlatching, the vacuum of air, the commotion in front of the nurse's station. She bobbed up, slid back under, listened harder, and thought she could hear his music, a bass pulse, a rampant tambourine. She dressed and walked out into the hallway where she saw Sarah passing information to Belinda, her description like a police report. Young, white male. 5'11", 170 pounds, green eyes, brown hair, missing little finger on right hand. Dinner was grilled cheese and tomato soup, squares of lemon sponge cake for dessert. The larded air, smoky and sweet, settled on Elise's tongue. There was a whisper, like moth's wings against a screen. Sarah reached across the table and snatched Elise's spoon, and then slipped it beneath her shirt. Everyone, the counselor announced, slapping the meat of her palms together, this is Lucas. She pointed to the empty place next to Sarah. He pulled out the chair, never taking his eyes off the food. Elise wondered at his stillness. Only when the sandwich was at his mouth did he look up. He seemed to consider their watchfulness for a moment, and then continued eating. When he tipped the bowl, a streamer of red soup ran down his chin. He's bleeding, Sarah screamed and covered her face with both hands. The purloined spoon clattered to the floor. When Lucas leaned down to pick it up, Elise saw the stub of his finger, a nubbin of bone cowled in flesh, a twitching half-joint tender and raw. Mr. Lambert ground his molars around a lettuce leaf and motioned toward the spoon. I wouldn't touch that if I were you, he said. It might be soiled. Elise began to explain to Lucas and then stopped. It wouldn't be generous to speak of Sarah's illness so bluntly, but Lucas was waiting, as were the others, to see what she would say. Sarah leaned a little his way and eyed his fork. Mind your utensils, Mr. Lambert cautioned. Sarah, Elise said a little too loudly. She lowered her voice. Why don't you tell us about your new picture of Daisy? Daisy was the Guernsey Sarah had been raising as a 4-H project before the first emergency room visit, the gynecological examination that produced 1.5 place settings of silverware. Sarah's parents sent holiday photos of the heifer. Daisy, muzzle painted with blood-fired fangs, cape tied at the bulge of her enormous neck. Daisy with reindeer antlers, nose rouged with lipstick. Daisy wearing fuzzy cow slippers, a birthday hat, and a placard reading, "Happy Moo Day." Sarah squealed, "Oh, she's so cute," and proceeded with an animated description of Daisy's Easter costume. Rabbit ears, a snout of whiskers, tail banded into a tuft. Elise nodded encouragement, even as she kept Lucas at the corner of her vision. As he ate, he surveyed the room, his gaze moving from left to right, ceiling to floor, as though he were reading the pages of a book. People were invisible, ghosts he could see right through. Was he dangerous, demented, disturbed, perhaps only depressed? In her short time at Clearwater, Elise had learned that not all illness requires the flesh, only the steady rain of impulse and compulsion. The severed finger might have been an accident, or a ritualized amputation. She wished she could see more of him, but he was finished with his meal and being guided into the closed room next door for examination, evaluation, observation, interrogation. The residents called it the Shun Room. It had taken Elise some time to realize the spelling, not to hear it as a place where people were shunned, and believe it justly named. The blinds tied against the windows, the locked door, there was no sound entered or escaped. You could lose your soul in there, feel it sucked out and into the air grate above the supervisor's desk. That concludes this installment of Kim Barnes' novel, A Country Called Home. We'll continue next time here on The Bookshelf from Spokane Public Radio. I'm Chris Massini.